Organized crime is not just some marginal security issue. It is a core development challenge for many countries around the world. As our Vox Dev Lit highlighted last year, where criminal groups gain a foothold, they have a host of negative impacts on societies and economies, with many of these manifesting in urban areas. Estimates from Italy show just how much these social costs can accumulate, where municipalities infiltrated by the mafia saw their GDP per capita fall by 16%. Welcome to Ideas in Development, a Vox Dev podcast on economic policy and research. I'm Oliver Hanney, the managing editor here at Vox Dev.
And I'm Curtis Lockhart, founder and executive director of the Africa Urban Lab. Today, we're asking how crime takes over cities, and if you're a mayor in a fast-growing city like many of those in Africa, how you can act before organized crime becomes entrenched. Joining us for this conversation is Chris Blattman, an economist, political scientist, and professor at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy. Chris, welcome to Ideas in Development.
Thanks for having me.
Chris, to start, could you tell us why crime is chiefly an urban problem?
I don't know if it's chiefly an urban problem when you think about some of the oil theft and the illegal mining and the production of illicit products like coca or marijuana. I think a lot of the violence is primarily an urban problem, at least in most cities. And I think this is probably because you get clusters of sometimes youth organizations that are quite informal. Sometimes you get more firm-like organizations. Sometimes you get these gang-like confederations that are competing for territory where they earn a lot of rents. So basically, if you're earning money from extortion, if you're earning money from retail drug sales, then you need to control territory. And for various reasons, that's going to lead to a lot of conflict with your neighbors. But you know, it's not universally true, right? And so we see a lot of violence in Mexico. That's competition for trafficking routes and border crossings and such. But other than Mexico, I would say I think it's a fair statement to say it's mostly concentrated in cities.
And could you walk us through the different steps on the ladder of how a criminal organization evolves?
Well, you know, I don't know that there's like a straightforward evolutionary path. There's definitely paths towards more and more sophistication that some groups follow and then fall back. And so I always hesitate to call it about evolution because it makes it sound like it's some inevitable pace. A lot of cities in the world, I would say a lot of street crime in New York today or a city where I've worked a great deal, which is Bogota, your crime's very atomized. And so you have individuals who are stealing cars or maybe you've got little burglary outfits or maybe there's a small cluster of guys who are selling drugs. But crime's very atomized. That can persist for a very long time, maybe forever. You know, it's very common, especially in poor neighborhoods, in the United States. We saw this in places like cities like Chicago and in lots of ethnic neighborhoods for the last 100 years, whether it was Jewish or Polish or Black or Latino. You see clusters of youth form informal groups of you know, what I think many people would, you know, maybe have traditionally called gangs of Chicago that, you know, the really organized gangs that sort of came about in the 80s and 90s dismissed those as gangs. They're like gangs of hierarchy, gangs of structure. Those don't. They might be doing illicit activities, but if they are, they're not doing it where in some, you know, pyramidal structure where the gang leader is like the residual claimant on all the profits, and they're, you know, they're little clusters of them are selling drugs or extorting. What you see in a lot of cities is with the growth of certain, you know, brands and I think retail drugs, basically selling drugs on the corner, and the expansion of a local drug market is then you see them grow into more hierarchical firms as they sort of shift from this sort of social grouping or this family into something that looks more like a business. It's kind of a hybrid. And then those firms, you know, having hundreds and hundreds of local firms competing for territory is pretty miserable. And so what you tend to see in a lot of cities is those firms evolve into confederations. So basically neighboring groups of gangs, somebody, you know, and it happens in different ways in different places, basically confederates them and basically helps them collude to not compete against, you know, why compete, you know, to drive the price down? And then also, why compete violently? Like, nobody's making money in the middle of a drug war. And so that's a very common pattern you see. Like I said, it's not, certainly not inevitable, and there aren't necessarily forces that are inevitably pushing towards that. In fact, there's a lot of forces that are pushing back. And so you see lots of cities in the world that are not really ever getting past this sort of fragmented youth gang situation.
And to anchor this in a specific place, you've done research in Medellin in Colombia. I was wondering if you could talk about how organized crime is currently structured in that city.
Yeah, so Medellin's really unusual and exceptional. I would say completely exceptional, because there's a handful of other cities on the planet that have achieved, I would say, what is like a complete criminal peace. It's one of the most hierarchical and well-structured criminal systems. The other example would be Sao Paulo in Brazil under the PCC. So right now the homicide rate in Medellin is one of the lowest in the hemisphere for any large city. We have this weird way of counting homicide statistics. I don't know where it comes from, but it's the number of deaths per 100,000. So Chicago right now is hovering around 20 or so. When it's spiked up in recent years and caused tons of consternation, it gets to about 30. It might have been 40 in the 1980s and 1990s. It's sort of peak conflict. The most violent cities in the world sometimes, you know, right now, which border town on the Mexican-U.S. border is the most violent? Sort of varies from, you know, month to month. Those might be around 100 per 100,000. But Medellin's down towards 10 right now, 10 or 11, which isn't quite New York and London levels of pacifism. But for a city with maybe 400 really well-organized, super well-paid, high-earning street gangs called combos, where literally every square inch of every, not just low-income, but every middle-income neighborhood is claimed by one of these gangs, long-standing, well-defined borders. It's a remarkable achievement, and it's an achievement because it went through this process of going from fragmented youth gangs into these firms, into confederations, underneath these like mafia-like organizations that go by many names. One that they use themselves and that in some cases and that we use is called Razones, which is the Spanish term for, the literal translation is reasons, but it's basically a Spanish term almost for corporation. And those are the big business. And so you've got about 17 or so Razones, each of which has maybe 20 combos in its territory, mostly geographically contiguous. Those 17 Razones have a couple of major alliances, and they fought over the years. And when Medellin has gone to war, when those confederations have gone to war, like they did, I'd say about, you know, 13, 14 years ago, their homicide rate was one of the highest in the world, above 200. But that wasn't very profitable, and it brought a lot of unwelcome attention from the state. And so they very slowly have crafted a set of sort of informal criminal institutions. And at the top of all these alliances, they have something they sometimes call la oficina, the office. And they've established a set of rules such as that if you want to go to war, if you want to knock someone out, you have to ask permission up the chain. And they've essentially fixed the drug market. So I don't know if they're exactly charging the perfect monopolistic price, but drug prices are highly elevated. There's a huge margin and markup between what they're paying for that drug and what they're selling it for. And so at every level up and down this chain, everybody's making money. Even some of the lowest ranking guys, the guy who's just sort of in, not even the middle manager who's running the corner, but the guy below him, is probably in the top 20% of the city's income distribution. And this is one of the wealthiest, you know, commercial and industrial cities in South America. So it's a really remarkable system that's slowly been constructed over decades.
And that's what I wanted to dig into next, like how Medellin got to this point, because you described it sort of morphed into these more hierarchical, vertically integrated firm structure almost, but it didn't start that way, right? So, you know, how did it start? I'm assuming it was more decentralized and scattered and fragmented. And I guess, like, what was the precipitating factor to nudge it, push it slowly over time towards more vertical integration or firm-esque?
Well, there's some things that are unique to Medellin, and there's some things that I think you find in other cities. So, you know, if we wanted to dwell on the history that was unique to Medellin, you'd point out that for a lot of this time there was a civil war, that there were leftist militias that had some presence in the city, that the right-wing paramilitary organizations inside and outside the cities were trying to exterminate, and those paramilitary organizations helped organize the gangs. And some of these razones have their roots in the paramilitary organizations that were demilitarized in 2003. And one of the first people who brought order to Medellin and constructed the first vestiges of La Oficina was a paramilitary leader who went by the alias Don Berna. And then, of course, Medellin is the birthplace of the coca trade, even globally, with, you know, everyone knows about, most people know about Pablo Escobar. And so there's a sort of unique history to Medellin that sort of brings it and makes it hierarchical. But I'd rather, you know, it's not the only city that's gotten to the point where it has these powerful confederations. Rio has gangs that have formed themselves into confederations, like the Red Command or Comando Varelo, or the Tercer Command. Chicago evolved from, as the drug trade grew, Chicago evolved to have from these fragmented youth groups into these firm-like structures, into confederations that they call nations. So I'm at Kenwood and 60th. This is my office. And if you go over three blocks, you get to Blackstone. You go three blocks further, you get to 63rd. Blackstone and 63rd is the birthplace of the Black Pistones. And the Black Pistones were just in the 60s or 70s, like a fragmented youth gang. They'd get into fist fights with all the other sort of unarmed, not particularly criminal. Maybe they were extorting a little, maybe they were selling a little bit of this, a little bit of that, but all these sort of youth gangs in this neighborhood south of here. And as the drug trade grew, many factors intervened, but basically it didn't really make sense to fight anymore. And the Black Pistones, sort of not as an outside paramilitary organization, but just because they were an ingenious, you know, well-led, charismatic, well-managed organization, managed to unify all of this area we know as Woodlawn in underneath the umbrella of the Black Pistones, kind of like a franchise operation. So just like Medellin, just like Rio, just like here, it's not some vertically integrated organization. A Razón isn't a vertically organization. The Red Command isn't a vertically integrated organization. It's like a franchise system, is maybe the closest analogy. It's just dozens and dozens of 10 to 30 person gangs. And just like a Razón is just 20 combos operating semi-autonomously underneath the umbrella of this Razón, who keeps the peace and helps them collude. And the demand for that partly comes from just the desire not to fight, but I think it really seems to accelerate when there's something like a retail drug trade.
So one tricky finding from your work is that violence and criminal power don't always move like neatly in tandem. Can you just like walk us through what happened after Don Berna's extradition and what that tells us about crime taking over?
Right. So, I mean, why is Chicago now? So first of all, why did Chicago's confederations never form an oficina like in Medellin? Why are those nations now gone? Why are we back to a landscape of hundreds and hundreds of fragmented youth gangs back to sort of the 60s and 70s or earlier? And why is Medellin at times been violent, or has the violence been contained? I mean, a big part of it is what the state decides to do. To what extent does the state tolerate, or I would say in a principled way, facilitate these confederations and their peace, or sometimes in an unprincipled way do so? And so in Medellin, when Don Berna started to build La Oficina and really try to structure crime in the city even more so than it had been under Pablo Escobar, organize the combos, start to establish some of these rules and norms. He did so initially from freedom. He did so subsequently from prison because he was arrested, but he was able to continue to control the street from the prisons, which is very common. And it was only when he was extradited to the U.S. in, I might get the year, it's either, I think it was 2008, but it might have been 2009, just because my memory gets worse as I age, that this basically the war of secession broke out. And it was this war of succession that consumed Medellin for basically 4 years, from roughly 2009 until when they finally sort of came to a peace agreement they called El Pacto del Fusil, the Pact of the Machine Gun, in roughly 2012. And violence was still quite high in 2012, but it's sort of come down tick, 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 as they've sort of really established this criminal peace amongst themselves. And the government in Medellin facilitates this. So first of all, it broke it down by chopping off the head, and not by just by imprisoning them, but by making it impossible for him to continue to govern, and didn't have to provoke a battle for succession. There could have been a smooth succession, but there isn't always, and there wasn't in this case. And then since then, I think subsequent governments have been very principled about this, and they don't negotiate with these gangs, but they understand that they don't want 200 homicides per 100,000, that these guys are very rich, they're very powerful. A great many politicians are not on the take, so they're not particularly corrupt, especially because the mayors turn over every 4 years. Hard to buy a government that's constantly changing. Happens, but it's hard to persist. And so they don't extradite these leaders. They make it possible to, or maybe they don't make it impossible to run the street from the prison. The gangs know that the city's going to come down hard on the gangs that are most violent. So they're disciplined in that way. And then there have been times when war and violence has started to escalate, and leaders in prison have suddenly found themselves coincidentally thrust into the same holding area for some obscure reason, right? Which is, of course, and they're basically told, you know, figure this out, or your life in prison is going to be much less pleasant than it was previously. It's not particularly, I've been in a lot of these prisons. It's not, you know, they're not living lives of luxury by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, maybe you can only have, maybe you have four people to your 4-bed cell instead of 10, which is the norm, right? That's a nice privilege. Chicago took and other cities have taken a very different stance. They just basically decapitate, 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 decapitate. They undertake other things. They make it difficult to run from the street, and they basically separate leaders, and they decimate these organizations, and they eliminate their ability to collude and to form these nations. And that's a completely different strategy. And that's a strategy that leads to sometimes peace and sometimes lots of escalatory spirals, as we've seen over the last few years. So with something we call the terrible trade-off, because, you know, it's basically, you know, you can have really rich, you know, there's sort of three things you want as a mayor. You'd like the gangs to be poor and not very powerful. You'd like there to be peace. And you don't want the whole polity to be completely corrupted, right? And you never really get all three. You can basically choose two, right? You can have fragmented gangs and an uncorrupted political system by organized crime, but then you have the danger of escalatory spirals of violence. You can get a criminal peace, and you can get low violence, so you can get low violence, and you can get maybe a relatively uncorrupted polity, but then you get really, really powerful gangs who are making money hand over fist. So it's not an easy choice. And so Chicago went one way, Medellin went the other. And, you know, I don't envy the politicians who have to make these decisions.
Just to summarize, that even if violence drops, the city can, by your trilemma, still be captured almost completely by organized crime. Beyond homicides, what are the kind of other negative impacts of this capturing by organized crime that matter most for other development outcomes that we care about?
There's many indications that these gangs at various elections try to bring out the vote for particular candidates for mayor, and there are either implicit or explicit agreements that, you know, we help put you in power and you're not the tough on crime guy and you're going to leave us alone. Or maybe there's even some explicit collusion. So there can be temporary political corruption through this sort of bring out the vote operation. Anyone in Colombia will know exactly which mayor I'm talking about, but you know, I don't think we have hard enough proof that I wanna name names. The second thing is that, like, if you're making this much money from this, so they're but maybe 20 or 30% of their rents are coming from extortion. The majority are coming from retail drugs, but they do a lot of things. They start to take over more and more little businesses. So if you have a cook stove, if you're middle class, lower class, whatever, you have a cook stove, it's a gas stove. It means you need this sort of gas canister called a pipeta. And locally, it's not that they have a monopoly on the pipetas, but basically they may have a local monopoly on the pipeta. You could now go downtown or something and get your pipeta from like a department store or something like that. But if it's kind of convenient, just the shoe leather cost to buy it locally, and there's a little bit of a markup. So they're making a little bit there. And a lot of the eggs and the arepas, which are the Colombian tortillas, and yogurt, and all of these other, and the bar shots that you buy on the side of the street, and all of these sorts of things start to get parceled out to combo members or their affiliates. And again, the markups are tiny, but it's a lot of it just starts to spread out and percolate till it's all over the economy. And then they've got to launder all of these illicit profits, especially from the drug rents. And so now you just get entire swaths of the retail sector and the commercial sector in bed with these organizations, and so on and so on and so on. So it just starts to, there's just so much money that it just starts to infiltrate and take over every aspect of the economy. And it's very difficult to know what to do about that.
I was wondering if you could talk a bit about the difficulties of researching this topic. One particularly unique example of how you've looked to shed light on this issue comes in a recent paper by yourself and co-authors, for which you interviewed the leaders of dozens of gangs and then also surveyed thousands of boys who are at school. How exactly did you pull that off?
It depends on the place. In Medellin, you can talk to the... It took us a long time. It took us years, literally, to figure out how to get inside and talk to people. We first thought it would be easier to talk to a lot of the low-level people, which was not true. They're much too scared. It took us years to realize that actually leaders felt quite free to speak. So and when I say leaders, I might meet a combo leader or a senior middle manager or someone in one of the razones, and it might be the top person or it might be, you know, a right-hand person to the top person. A lot of them are in prison, and we discovered somewhat by accident that they are quite open to talking. When you're in prison, you know, there's no double jeopardy, so they can't be reindicted. Also, we're not asking them, you know, where did you put the money? There's lots of questions you can't answer. We're not asking them. We're asking them like the mundane details of like how the business operates. And also, you know, they're proud in many ways of the piece they've built and the firms they've built, right? Just like any CEO would be. And they told us this, but I think it's evident, but several have told us this, that it's kind of refreshing just to talk to somebody who like actually understands how it works and respects it in the sense that we're just like factually taking for granted a lot of the things they do and the things they've accomplished. And we're just trying to get at the details. And they sort of see a real, you know, the unhelpful thing about having a mayor that changes every 4 years and therefore a secretary of security that changes every 4 years and a police chief that's changing every few years as well, is they get rotated in and they don't understand how any of this works. And they're like, these guys have no idea how strong and important we are. And I have no problem, you know, with resolving information asymmetries. We spend a lot of time before every mayoral campaign talking to any campaign that will listen to us about how this works so that they come in and at least, you know, make informed decisions. But basically, so they, I think, but most of them don't talk to us, but a significant proportion have. I think we probably met with close to 100.
From this research, what exactly did you learn about why teenagers decide to join these gangs?
First thing I say is I don't, you know, don't try this at home necessarily. First of all, I didn't waltz in there as like some, you know, Canadian American with intermediate Spanish and like just start interviewing prison leaders. We worked very carefully with local journalists and local ethnographers, and we have a whole team, and we have a very deep bench of people who specialize in this. And I joined some of the interviews, but I'm definitely, you know, I can handle a government meeting, but my like my prison street lingo of what's called paisa is not very good. And you couldn't do this in any city. I'd say because these are so ordered, you know, this is very safe to do in Medellin. You know, anyone who knows anything about Mexico knows that anybody who starts digging into this with cartels in Mexico finds themselves dead. Thousands of journalists killed, I think. So that wouldn't be true for street gangs in Mexico. I'm starting some work in various parts of Mexico where you could talk to street gangs. That's not an issue, really, if you have an intermediary who trusts. But you have to do this very carefully, and you have to do it through, you know, local colleagues who really understand what's safe and what's not. And we spent years figuring out what's safe and what's not. And so you know, we don't have the same depth of data in other places, but you know, some of my colleagues do. I work with Ben Lessing very closely. He's been able to do a lot of this kind of qualitative work throughout Brazil. So it is possible. You talked about young boys and their decision to join. That's like the other end of things. Like, you know, most people, if they're joining one of these combos, they typically join between the ages of like 14, mostly 15 to 18, it seems. And so we thought, well, if we want to understand who's joining and why, because there's lots of motivations, right? Is it status? Is it the money? Is it girls? Is it fun? Is it misconceptions about any of the above? Is it a short-sightedness about the risk of arrest or death? We said, well, we have to catch them before they join and before they drop out of school, which really starts to pick up around grade 7 and 8. And so, again, we spent a year trying to figure out how to ask these questions by repeatedly failing. So just like we repeatedly failed to interview and meet and develop relationships with combo leaders before we finally figured it out, it took us at least a year and a half before we figured out how to ask these questions in such a way that we thought we were getting pretty good data. And now we're starting to run surveys of what are now about 20,000 kids a year. I'm hoping it'll be the entire grade 7-8 population of the city every year, starting next year. A bunch of questions that try to gather their expectations about all of these various incentives. And the short answer is, you know, we can get very economistic, and we're running like structural models that try to get at, you know, exactly how responsive does people's interest in joining, you know, respond to their beliefs about how much you earn or how much status you get. But the short answer is all of these factors are very influential. The other interesting thing is the ones who are most likely to join are the ones who tend to overestimate the fun and the social status they're going to get from this, because there's any number of older guys that will tell you it's not all that. And they all most of them tend to get out by the time they're 30 or so. And they tend to underestimate the risk of arrest and death. And they actually tend to really underestimate what they could earn in the private sector if they stayed on the legal path and they just did some basic tertiary education. Something as simple as simply not knowing that for their income bracket, which is basically lower and even lower middle class, all vocational education is free in the city. And they don't know that. And they think this is not for them or not accessible. So there's a lot of misconceptions that we're working to revise. Whether or not any of those work, I don't know. You'll have to check back with me in a year or two, because we're running some experiments on that. But we're sort of trying to see, can we manipulate some of these beliefs? Manipulate in the sense of correct some of these beliefs. And then at least, you know, maybe influence more and more of them away from choosing this path.
Switching gears a bit to state building, Charles Tilly wrote a well-known article titled War Making and State Making as Organized Crime. North Wallace Weingast's Violence and Social Orders basically models elites in the early stages of development as engaged in this sort of protection racket. So I guess first, having studied both organized crime and development economics yourself, do you agree with this characterization? And then second, what can developing country governments who want to be more effective learn from the most efficient organized crime networks about state building.
It's certainly true that, you know, we talked about this evolution from firms into confederations. The experience of going to war, I would say, helps build these criminal governance institutions, right? Basically, criminals governing other criminals. Because that the violence and the cost of that and the profits that are to be made through peace are so attractive that it's a huge incentive to basically criminal institution build. And that's something we're writing up right now about the story of Medellin. And I'm starting some interviews in, we're just sort of on month one of interviews of a bunch of guys who are my age or older, who would have been gang leaders or middle managers in Chicago in the 80s and 90s, trying to understand the transition into these confederations and the more business-like organization. I think that war making is very important, but not just in this Tilly-like way, because, you know, it weeds out the weak. And the strong survive, and they only survive if they learn how to tax. So I think it's partly because they just realize, my goodness, there has to be a better way to make money. And they do that through peace as well. You know, Charles Chilly doesn't talk about something called defensive modernization, which is the idea that you might actually state build or criminally institution build merely because of the threat of war, right? You don't actually, it's not necessarily the act of war making itself that is necessary. It's actually just the threat of that is actually very incentivizing. Often we see like a mix of both. So there's a lot of parallels there. And I do think that's how you go along this not quite evolutionary path towards confederations, but because of this, because people sort of realize, I think there's a famous line from Godfather 2 or something where one of the Dons says, I'm a businessman, I hate war. And I've just heard that in so many cities over and over and over again, in some version or another.
And moving on to how cities actually respond to crime or should respond to crime. As I mentioned in the intro, at VoxDev, we have this VoxDev Lit on organized crime, which summarizes research in this area. It was led by some of your co-authors, Santiago Tabon and Mika Sfiacci. I guess one of my takeaways from editing that and therefore reading it kind of four or five times all the way through was that it's just really, really hard to deal with organized crime once it becomes entrenched and there's essentially not really many good options. Before getting into kind of how good the options are, I was wondering if you could lay out some of the different options that policymakers have available to them.
I'll say the biggest mistake a lot of policymakers, like a mayor or a police chief, makes is they'll look at New York and its homicide reduction and the 80s and 90s and 2000s and say, oh, maybe we need comp stat and police professionalization and hotspots policing. Or they look at Chicago and its construction of these amazing, what I call outreach organizations that are doing a variety of things like violence interruption and mediation and programs that basically help people exit or slow down their thinking and be less violent. And they say, oh, maybe we should do that. Or they look at Bukele, President Bukele in El Salvador, who through a mixture of martial law and mass arrests, basically put virtually every gang member and then some people in prisons. And they say, well, let's do that. And that's just makes no sense whatsoever, right? There's no one-size-fits-all solution because all these organizations are super different. So it's a little bit, and we forget that. So the analogy I like to use is like we go to our doctor. And if we went to our doctor and we said, doc, you know, my chest hurts. And the doctor said, hey, you know, the last person who came in with chest pains turned out to be cancer. We gave them chemo. Let's start you right away. Right. All of us would know instantly that this person is a quack. We need a new doctor. And then we go in and we say, hey, doctor, you know, I've got this violence problem in my city. And what should I do? And he says, well, you know, Chicago did this violence interruption stuff. So like, let's do that. And we, instead of saying, this person's a quack, let's get a new doctor, we say, sign me up. And so somehow we turn off that part of our brains. And so now it's not that there's a million diseases and a million solutions and there's just no answer. It's actually, you just sort of have to figure out where you're at. Like if you are Bukele and you're facing a set of very well-organized confederations, basically three confederations, right? So that's these, you know, the famous Mara Salva Chucha. These are not like vertically integrated organizations of 10,000 people. This was a confederation of like hundreds of like small gangs with a loose leadership structure. And they were completely dependent on extortion. There was no retail drug market. Virtually no retail drug market. And their sole source of, almost, their almost sole source of revenue worth speaking of was extortion. And this made them profoundly unpopular, and it made them profoundly vulnerable. Because if you knock those people out, you don't have like citizens in that neighborhood clamoring for someone to come back and extort them. Even if they were providing some security services, which actually, and which some do, like in Medellin, but actually they weren't really in El Salvador. So that's actually a very weak structure to begin with. And so if you do, by a mixture of luck and deception and whatever, manage to take out these bandits who are extorting you, yes, like it's way too soon to say, and there's lots of reasons to be cautious, but maybe he's actually solved the country's problem. If you did that in Medellin or in Chicago, and you just could wave a magic wand and pop all of these people into, you know, a Megamax prison somewhere, you would have thousands, tens of thousands of people who were buying their drugs, who are like, where do I get my fix? And they're going to be clamoring for somebody to come back, and someone will fill that gap. Someone will fill that demand. So that's just a fun, that's like the cancer and the heart attack, right? Like they're just totally different. And so there are all of these countries around the hemisphere that are saying, maybe we need to do what Bukele did. And if they have a retail drug market, it's such a stupid and naive way of dealing with things. So it kind of depends. And I think the cities that are stuck the worst, and I think there are some options. There are several cities that have had serious drug problems. I was just in Kingston, Jamaica. The Jamaicans, some would argue they actually invented crack, or at least spread it through the U.S. initially, and they had their own crack problem. Nobody uses cocaine or crack really to any significant degree in Jamaica. I'm not 100% sure why, but they got over that. So maybe the drug market can go away. That's hard. So you're in a very different situation in that case. So you know, the policies and tools you'll take that. So why does Medellin take this sort of slightly disciplined, I think, principled accommodation tool? Is because they're like, look, we don't know how to get rid of the drugs. We don't want a city bathed in violence. These guys are very powerful. And so we need to use this mixture of what we call focused deterrence or conditional repression. We need to allow them to negotiate. We need to put pressure to sort of on them to keep the peace. And the costs of that are very powerful criminal groups. So treatment has to fit the diagnosis.
So, I mean, this is like literally the perfect end to your past answer. How then should cities go about diagnosing the specific problems that they face?
It's striking to me how few cities invest in this in any deliberate way. Now, there's always a handful of experts. They might be security experts. They might be a gang intelligence unit that's been marginalized. They might be an academic who have some idea of what's going on. Sometimes it's quite sophisticated. I've just seen all sorts of things in various cities. I've been surprised at how many senior security officials and mayors and police chiefs don't really grasp what's going on in their city. Particularly, you know, there's a whole bunch of countries that have not seen a lot of this, have not had high violence problems, Ecuador, Peru, Chile, that in the last few years have suddenly seen all of these gangs and the violence pop up. And it's been brewing for years. And they really weren't paying attention until these groups had evolved to the point where they were started to fight, and their fighting had huge, huge costs. And so now I think they're retroactively investing and trying to figure out what's going on. but not, as far as I can tell, in a very systematic or open source way. What we've been trying to do in Medellin, and now we're trying to do in Rio and Mexico City and perhaps elsewhere, are sort of build these, we don't quite have a name for it. We thought about urban labs, but now you've got, what, you have the Africa Urban Lab, Curtis, so we'll have to.
We have to
think of something.
We'll chat after.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's Urban Labs here in Chicago. So what we name this thing and what we construct over the next few years is to be determined. But in addition to sort of doing the kinds of things that, you know, collecting all the data and running experiments or quasi experiments, and we're also trying to really build a diagnosis engine that we can then replicate and export. But it's going to be different everywhere, partly because the criminals won't talk to you everywhere, partly because they're structured differently. But I do think it could be built and systematized. And the way we do it is that it's open source, in the sense that, when someone consents to talk to us, even a top criminal leader, we mentioned that, look, everything's going to be anonymous, but everything's shareable. Everything will be shared in an aggregate way. And other researchers also have access to these transcripts or notes that are anonymized. And we collect them in, we were in a sort of an encrypted wiki. Now we're migrating over to some other systems. We're starting to use LLMs because we just have so many notes and interviews. But basically, other people are going to be able to access this, right? And so we're working with other qualitative researchers around the region who are collecting this kind of data to build this in so that we can share this information. Because one of the problems is, even when you do get an expert or they have their interviews or they have their notes, it sits in a file drawer and they don't bother sharing it, or they protect it so that they can write about it, or they're not allowed to share it, or whatever, just innocuous stuff. And just trying to give a little bit of coordination and incentive to sort of make that more open source and make that more accessible, I have to think is going to be helpful, especially in the age of where text is data and where, you know, it's so much easier to analyze this at scale.
This is just me responding, but I know, like, Ricardo Hausman and co at Harvard Kennedy do growth diagnostics. It sounds like you're proposing a similar thing, but for kind of crime in the city, which is really fascinating. So just moving to Africa, where organized crime, it's more in its infancy than in Latin America. Are there particularly effective early interventions that African governments can implement that have been or that have shown to nip the emergence of organized crime in the bud before it becomes pervasive and entrenched and the big problems start to occur?
Well, I mean, I don't know that African cities are so unlike many South American cities, because there are all these parts of South America that up till recently had not really been touched, right? So Santiago de Chile, they just thought they were beyond all that. And Ecuador and Peru, just, they at least in the cities, they just weren't, they didn't have to deal with, you know, that was a Colombia problem. That was a Brazil problem. That was a Venezuela problem. That was a Mexico problem. We weren't on a trafficking route. Until they were, because people said, hey, those ports are really, really valuable. And that's a big part of what's going on. It's a transshipment point. And my worry about a lot of African cities and a lot of the most promising and successful places, a lot of the promising and successful places are promising successful places because they're easy places to trade from. And they're places that are going to be trying to trade with Europe and Asia and the United States and South America. And so those are wonderful places through which to move these products, for which there seems to be insatiable European and American demand and increasing local demand in South America, potentially in Africa, maybe eventually in Asia. And the thing is there's no early intervention evidence. First of all, there's no evidence for almost anything I'm talking about, because nobody tests these things at all. You know, outside the United States, I would say. So this little cluster, me, Santiago, Mika Siachi, you know, a handful of other, Rodrigo Canales, there's a very small group, are among the first to do so. And that's one of the things we're trying to scale up. But nobody intervenes like ex ante, where they're like, oh, maybe, you know, Santiago de Chile should be laser focused on how do we avoid developing a retail drug market, right? Because, you know, these retail drug market, you know, they're a little bit like herpes. Like, once you've got them, you know, you've got them. And so if I were, you know, in charge in Lagos or Nairobi or something, I would just be laser focused on that. I would also be laser focused on not making my port an attractive place for these goods to transship through. How do you do that? I don't know. Unfortunately, that ends up just being like a game of whack-a-mole, you know? So in a very selfish way, like if I'm, you know, in Nigeria or Kenya or something, I'm going to really try to make my port as unattractive as possible. That's just going to make the port in Ghana or the port and somewhere else just that much more attractive, right? So you're going to just see these groups gravitate towards the places that don't get on top of these things. That doesn't solve the global problem, which they're probably going to transship to somewhere. But I would be laser focused on once they start transshipping through, making sure it doesn't spill over into organizing the local gangs and building out their local drug trade, which, because that's what happens, right? You're pushing all this cocaine through the country. You're pushing all these pills through the country, and it spills over in the sense that some people are like, hey, I can make a little money on the side selling this here. And it's a small problem at first because you've got to build a market. It takes like 20 years to build a retail drug market. It takes effort and investment. But my worry is that in 30 or 40 years, Lagos looks like Rio.
So, Chris, you responded to an article I wrote about African cities last summer in Asterisk magazine that the crime problem made you worried about the future of African cities. I know you just kind of went over some aspects as to why that's the case, but can you elaborate on this a little more? How do you see this sort of playing out in the near to medium future?
I used to work a lot in West Africa and East Africa. I haven't physically been there since, I'm going to say, maybe 2013. So my efforts to get back there and actually try to study this in Nigeria were stymied by Mr. Musk and Mr. Trump and the cancellation of some work where we're going to actually look into what seems to be a very nascent set of gangs in a city like Lagos, which will soon be the world's largest, who seem to have some of their roots in scamming, but potentially extortion. There's a lot of nascent organized criminal structures that look a lot like these nascent decentralized youth gangs in a lot of cities in this hemisphere. And you see this, and this has been, and of course they're very well developed in South Africa. I don't know a lot about what's going on in Kenya, but I'm not even going to pronounce it correctly. The Munyiki, or I can't, you know, they played a role in some of the election violence several years back. My understanding is that I know so little about them that I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing this correctly, but you hear all of these whispers, and I cannot point to. I'm sure they're out there, and this is my ignorance, but I spend a lot of time researching, reading, and then I also ask ChatGPT deep research to find these things for me. And I just can't find a lot of people who are looking into these groups, but they make me very worried, because you take that and then you mix that with those countries gradually becoming major transshipment points of cocaine and pills to Europe. And you mix that with, you know, states that are certainly not impenetrable to corruption if they're not already quite corrupted, with not very sophisticated police forces, and who are almost laser focused on insurgencies and security problems in their peripheries and are just ignoring their cities, and highly centralized governments who don't give any power or give very, very little power to mayor and police chiefs, right? So highly centralized. And though the seat of government might not be in the biggest and most organized criminal city, and so the incentives of that president or that security minister to like take care of issues in Lagos might be very limited, right? All of this is like very scary to me. And that's just I just think, you know, maybe Lagos will get lucky, and maybe Accra will get lucky, and maybe Abidjan, and on and on and on, right? But I just doubt it, right? Santiago de Chile. Santiago is like the Germany of South America in the sense it's like a regimented life. Like, you don't break a law at all. You know, I was there. I've only been there for a few days. We got pulled over in my Uber like six times just to like, because of, not for corruptions or payoff, but literally the taillight was broken. The tinting on the window is off. They don't take anything. And they're, and all of a sudden they're getting these groups and they're panicked and they're a strong state. And they don't know what to do about it. And so I'm terrified what a less prepared government is going to do when these groups inevitably come.
Thanks so much for joining us, Chris. This has been Ideas in Development, a VoxDev podcast. Please give us a like or 5-star rating wherever you are listening or watching. And as always, all past episodes can be found on voxdev.org.